I think I just started it, yes.
Okay. Does it clip on?
So it's now recording?
You can literally just stick
let me make sure
that.
And am I on?
Make sure it is.
No, should I turn it on now?
Yes, it's recording.
All right.
Careful what you say now.
I know, now I have to be careful. No cussing anybody out. That'd be bad. And then, yeah, you're good. You did it. Mama, you have movie pass. Isn't that like the best thing ever? I'm sorry, I saw inside your wallet.
Do you have it?
Yes.
Mom, how do I record again?
Oh, shoot.
No, I turn it on, and then you hold it down.
I don't know. I thought you knew.
I don't know. Okay.
That's kind of important.
I don't know. Well, I know.
I know you know. Here, hold
it's
off.
It's supposed to blink twice. It's just supposed to blink twice. That's all I know. And I can't remember exactly. Shoot.
Okay, why don't you text Dad?
Okay, well, does that mean we're screwed on this first little chunk?
Yeah, just text him. And say, Dad, remind me of how to turn it on.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, hooking myself all up.
Hubby not here today?
Not here today.
To hook you up?
Correct. And so everybody's scrambling trying to figure it out, because when Tim's not here, you need about four people to take his place. But that is how good he is at taking care of things.
I need to get on my redeem. Gotcha.
No, we ran out last week and I felt bad.
Oh, they did? You did?
Well, we didn't bring the whole box. Tim didn't. So.
Is your daughter?
Yes. Let's start. I'm gonna run it. Nick's supposed to be here, but he's still in bed.
Oh, I thought
you want.
She's running the. You can just put it in here, Carrie. Just put it right in there. Jan, do you have, is that for me? So there's a button back here.
It's turned on.
It's turned on, and then these have to be up.
They do. Those are for the lights. Lights.
Hello,
work.
Hello.
We're trying to get it to work. I've got all the nines on. So if
hello, hello.
Can I talk to your dad? Is he there?
I just hung up on him. I can call him again.
Please do. Because I can't get the sound.
Call me after the mic.
Okay.
I followed his directions, but...
You want lights?
The microphone's not working.
Oh, well, I'd say good.
Go ahead, start. Yeah.
We'll work on it while you're
talking. John, can you start us with a prayer? Mike is not here today.
All right, we'll start with a prayer. Thank you, God, for bringing us here this morning. It's great having a weekend where we don't have to go to work. Father, I'm thankful that you've given us truth, you've given us knowledge of you, that you want to have a relationship with us, Father. And I pray that we'd be stewards of the information we're getting this in these few classes and use them well to your glory. Mm-hmm. God, it's a troubled world. It really is. And God, yeah, many of us here, we have our own troubles. But Father, I pray that we would find healing, that we'd offer healing. I'm thankful for the way you've used Jennifer and trained her. And God, I pray you bless her ministry in many ways. Be with us this morning. Thank you for the food as well. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Today is a little different as far as even in format. I'm not going to do a teach it, ask questions at the end. This is an ongoing, like, integrative, constantly put your hands up kind of day. I mean, constantly doesn't mean you have to, but if you have questions, feel free. This is what we've, of course, covered the other weeks, the disciples' approach, the DSM, anxiety and depression, sex and drugs. Today is really focused on what happens in therapy, what types of therapy there are. This is actually one of the biggest questions I get asked. It's funny, on who do I see and how do I figure out who to see? Oh my gosh, there's all these like different letters out there after people's names, and what do those letters mean, and how do I pick somebody, and so on. And Jennifer, this is what we're doing. Is this what, you know, somebody will share with me how what they're doing with their therapist, and is this what therapists do? Or people will call me and they're getting ready for their first session. What's going to happen? I've never been to therapy. I'm not sure what. So the specifics, the mechanics of what therapy looks like is a little bit of what we're also going to look at. It's important for you to know the different types of training and beliefs and theories behind how different therapists practice, because what they've been trained in and what their approach is influences what they're going to do with you in that room. And they're by no means the same. Not only is every therapist just a different person, but the modes that they use, the models that they use in doing therapy are radically different. So what you're physically going to be doing in there and verbally going to be doing there is going to differ greatly. So I'm going to explain some of that. And then, you know, over the long term, as disciples, how do we use that and maintain change through life, right? And then I am going to hit, and, you know, you may think, well, how do the law and ethics apply to me? They actually do. Their law and ethics are written for you. They're actually written for a therapist to make sure they're doing a good job taking care of you. So it's probably important that you know what those laws and ethics are, because if you have a therapist that doesn't obey them, then actually their license should possibly be either temporarily removed or revoked. So there are laws around what you can and can't do in therapy. So that's important. So let's just dive in, and feel free at any time to stick your hand up. We have nowhere near the number of slides today. But actually, I'm going to read this to you because I just think it's like really funny. Well, okay, I'll just read it. So it's Canadians and Americans. Canadians say, please, there's a big old boat in the ocean, and he's sending out a signal to the Canadians. Please, and the Canadians reply, please divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid collision. The Americans say, we recommend, he's sending this signal to a boat. We recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. Negative. You will have to divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. This is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. I say again, divert your course. No, I say again, you divert your course. This is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the United States Atlantic Fleet. We are accompanied by 3 destroyers, 3 cruisers, and numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. I say again, that's 15 degrees north, or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of this ship. This is a lighthouse. Your call. There are times where we're looking for directions on how to get around, and we're like, this is what we need. And sometimes we come up against different things that we either don't understand or don't realize are right in front of us. So this is kind of a joking way to say, this is the reality of our lives, and this is sometimes the reality of relationships, and this is the reality of even seeking therapy. So, you know, how do we overcome barriers like a lighthouse, right? I love, this is one of my favorites. Lucy, her sign, psychiatric help for 5 cents. I have deep feelings of depression. What can I do about this? Snap out of it. 5 cents, please. Hopefully, when you see a therapist, you get a little more help than that, right? So, yeah, Lucy, the ultimate psychiatrist. Okay, that's what she says she is. Psychiatric help, actually. Sorry, Lucy. If you stuck that sign out, you could be in really big trouble, because she's not trained as a psychiatrist. And if you put a sign out that says therapy, and you are not a therapist, and you are not a licensed therapist, you are going against the law. Well, what is a therapist? There are all kinds of different kinds. There are psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, researchers. That's kind of a good broad picture. So what's the difference? Well, don't read the rest yet. A psychiatrist is an MD. So they have a medical degree, and they can prescribe medicine, okay? They can write on the pad. A psychologist has a PhD or a PsyD, one of two degrees, and they cannot prescribe except in certain states. I think Texas is one of them, that if they get certain other increased training specific to doing the medical part of it, then they can prescribe. But almost everywhere, a psychologist cannot prescribe. Then a therapist is more clinically focused, which means their main focus is meeting with people and talking with people and doing talk therapy. So that would be a psychotherapist. People ask me, am I a psychotherapist? And that always makes me think, yeah, I'm one of those crazy therapists, psycho, woo! But psychology, so psychotherapist is actually what that term is, so I just use the word therapist. I don't use the word psychotherapist. In fact, somebody asked me that yesterday, are you a psychotherapist? And I said yes, but I was so funny saying that. That doesn't mean that psychologists and psychiatrists don't provide therapy, because actually the field of therapy started in the field of psychiatry. Today, most psychiatrists only prescribe. They see somebody for 5 to 15 minutes. They okay the change in your prescription. They might do an hour the first time. They should, actually. If they don't, that might not be the best psychiatrist, because they should take a full session to do a good evaluation before they decide what medication to give you. And then the rest of your appointments are usually follow-up appointments. Some psychiatrists do therapy as well, because they're trained in therapy. But they make a lot less money doing therapy. So there's a money difference. You put the MD after a name and you sign a prescription pad, you make more money. I'm not saying that's their motivation. Not saying that at all. I'm just saying there is a rather large difference between the amount that you make when you're sitting for somebody with an hour versus seeing 5 clients in that hour and changing their prescriptions. A psychologist is predominantly someone that is in the assessment area of treatment, meaning they might not be a child psychologist who does child assessments, or an adult psychologist in a hospital that does assessments in a hospital. So psychologists are very involved in the assessment process. Some of them also do therapy. In fact, a lot of them also do therapy. That's a little bit more common. But today, the predominant people that do the talking part are what you would call a clinical psychologist or a therapist. So the psychologists and the psychiatrists have actually become more specialized. Again, that's not every psychologist or every psychiatrist. There are plenty of psychiatrists and psychologists that do therapy. So somebody will be called themselves a psychologist, but what they mean is a psychotherapist who has a psychologist degree, a psychology degree, a PhD. I have a PsyD. It just means a doctor of psychology. PhD is a doctor of philosophy. I'm not quite sure why. Most psychologists, it's just a funny thing. It's the doctor of philosophy to be a psychologist. I think it should probably be a doctor of psychology to be a psychologist. But you can actually, so then there's licensure. There's a degree, and then there's licensure. So PhDs set people up for the psychologist boards, sets them up to take the test to become licensed as a psychologist. PsyDs can be either. They can license as a psychologist, or they can license as a therapist. Therapists can actually license at a master's level. Psychologists can only license at a doctoral level. So I could have chosen to do both licensures. I have no interest in being a psychologist. That is, my training is the same as a psychologist. I want to be in the office with people, so I got a therapy license. So you just want to know the difference between people's degrees and people's licensures, and what those letters are that you're looking at when you're checking out who to see. And then there are people that have those same degrees, but they actually don't see people at all. They don't write the prescriptions. They don't do therapy. They don't do assessments. They purely do research. So I am a researcher. most people with a PsyD are clinicians and not researchers. Most PhDs, that would be a psychologist, are researchers and they teach in the universities. So I teach in the, so they cross over, okay? Specifically, if somebody provides therapy, typically in California, that would be a marriage and family therapist. That's the license I have. There's several licenses in California for the person you're going to sit in the office with. Again, psychiatrist, psychologist. Marriage and family therapist is the MFT license. Clinical social worker, so that's the LCSW. So, and that's not even on my top one up there, which it should be actually. So social work is also a way to become a therapist. You can get a undergraduate and then get a graduate in social work and then you become a, and with a master's, that's not actually, you cannot practice in, well, you can be an intern with a master's. So once you get your master's, either in social work or marriage and family therapy, you have to do 3,000 hours, which takes about 2 years of therapy, like a doctor who goes into their residency. So you have this time period of training, takes about, it can take not 6 years, but generally about 2 to 3 of, you're under supervision the whole time. So same thing with an LCSW is a licensed clinical social worker. That means they've gone through their 3,000 hours under supervision. They've taken their state boards, and they're now a licensed clinical social worker, which means they can do therapy. They don't have the word therapy in their title, but that's what they can now provide. A marriage and family therapist is, they're very, very similar, LCSWs and MFTs, in that a similar number of hours, similar what you can do after you get the license. LCSWs in general, they will say, has a broader application, meaning the type of jobs that they will hire you for are a bit broader with an LCSW license or degree. Professional counselors is the newest one here in California, licensed professional counselors and LPC. There was a time period where everybody with MFTs could grandfather in and have both. I never did it, but you'll see that. LPC is the other big label that is building in California. It just got approved a couple years ago, and similar thing. And LPC, okay, so what's the difference between the therapy fields? Social work is more community-focused. It's not necessary. They do get some training in psychotherapy. That's not their focus, though. Marriage and family therapy is systemically focused, which means it's very specific to the systemic field of family therapy, which began in the 1950s. And so it's very focused on the whole family, the community, and so on, the system someone lives in. Licensed professional counselors are more individually focused, meaning actually they cannot see families and couples, I believe, because they are not trained in couples and family. They do individual work. A clinical psychologist, yeah, clinical psychologists are mostly trained in individual therapy, but then they take family courses. So there's just different emphasis. An MFT, I tell people, if you're going to go to marriage therapy, family therapy, you need to go to an MFT because they're actually trained in marriage, in family therapy. The other systems of thinking don't include that in their training, or it's just a class in their training, versus the entire training is focused on that. So different types, right? When you're looking them up, and if you have a question when you're looking at some, Jennifer, who is this? You can feel free to send it to me. I get that all the time. So, like I said, social work is one of the specialized fields. School psychologists are master's degree psychologists, meaning the work that they do is predominantly assessment within the schools. They actually are not supposed to be providing ongoing therapy. That's not their job descriptions often, though, because the schools are not funded for therapy. The school psychologists are overwhelmed with trying to meet the needs of these, therapeutically of these kids, but they're overwhelmed with just doing the assessments and keeping up with the IEPs. That is actually the, I worked with all the psychologists in Valley Center and Escondido. I was the school therapist, and they're all like, oh, thank God you're here, because on the IEP, it required therapy for the kid, and there was nobody to do that. And so national funding was given to low-income areas, and that's how I was hired there. So a school psychologist can become a psychologist. They're just different labels, okay? Forensic psychology is, as you can imagine, that would be in the law and legal field where you're using forensics to do, okay, what was in the mind of that individual, so CSI-ish kind of way of looking at things. let me just explain some of these. So, like clinical psychology, which would be really along the lines of, yeah, Mike, this just go away. Sorry, I keep getting some flash up, and luckily you don't see it. A psychologist is primarily analyzing, identifying, treating, and preventing mental disorders and issues. So that would be straight out of most of the textbooks. So you'll notice that clinical psychology is going to be a little bit more focused. Ah, yeah, I need to explain this. A bit more focused on dysfunction and disorder. Notice the DYS and the DIS in those two words. It's very focused on the DSM. The DSM is actually written by psychiatrists. And so it is dysfunction-focused. MFTs tend to be a little about the DSM. We're fully trained in it, but we don't necessarily like using the diagnoses unless somebody needs it to provide better treatment, to provide insurance coverage. So there's this kind of war between these different names up here. And actually, there are plenty of psychologists that would say, I don't like the diagnosing. I don't like the DSM. So these all overlap. Industrial, do I have that on here? See, under sports psychology would be within the field of sports medicine, somebody really working through some of the issues that come with rehabilitation and injury and all the things that are happening in their life that are challenging around their professional work. Industrial and organizational psychologists, so that's, like you can imagine, that's working with employees and studying employees and figuring out workplace environment, organizational structure, why is a company like having all the problems that they're having? You'll have an organizational or an industrial psychologist come in and figure out what's the relationships within the company. It's very, very, all of these are, well, this one especially I think is very relationally based. Actually, when I speak with people who work in this kind of field, they're like, oh, we almost do the same work. Because when you're working with families versus when you're working with a company, there are a lot of similar dynamics. Neuropsychology would be, so this is a neuropsychologist. So this is somebody that is a psychologist, but their specialty, their degree is in the brain. So they might just do assessments similar to what I'm talking about earlier. They might actually take someone through treatment, and there's all kinds of different treatments. I'm trained in neuropsychology because I work so much with things that have to do with the brain that I was like, I just need some extra stuff to understand all of that. So, and then you have guidance counselors. So this would be where the word counselor is used rather than therapist. I was actually really turned off when I realized that my license was a therapy license. I was like, I don't want to be a therapist. I want to be a counselor. I was like, that sounds so therapy. And I literally, my master's, I had to sit there and go, their LPC wasn't even here at the time, the licensed professional counselor. I probably would have ended up with an LPC, which I'm actually glad I didn't, because I wouldn't have had quite the level of training in family systems that I ended up having. But I really was quite reactive to the word therapist, and it's funny because I still kind of am. I like the word counselor. It's biblical. So, and then there's those that specialize in developmental psychology. Again, they might have the similar degrees, a PhD, PsyD, but they focus on children or the lifespan. So the progress of mental health through the lifespan. Most of the time when you see developmental psychology, it's going to be somebody that works with kids. It specializes in development during the developmental years. And then throw in there, you've got the whole field of music therapy. You can get a master's in music therapy. I wish I had. My undergrad is in musical theater, vocal performance, and everybody, we had a whole music therapy department there. It was brand new. Music therapy is not that old. It's only been around for a couple decades, and I had a full scholarship and a full ride, and I should have double majored. But I wasn't a disciple. Nobody gave me that input. Nobody even knew that field was there. So there was when I did become a disciple in college, somebody could have said, you know, you should, and I could have ended up, right? I could have been in psychology for about 30 years now. Because I've actually been trained now in music therapy. I cannot claim to be a music therapist because you have to have a separate degree, but I use music in therapy, and I've done that quite a bit. And that's art and music therapy are huge. You can actually get a master's in art therapy now. So there are other forms of masters that are more specific to the actual what they're going to do in the room piece. So a lot of people ask me, well, Jennifer, like disciples will say, can we see you? They're in a different state. I can only practice in the state of California and outside of the United States. We have specific laws that you cannot, so even online, I can't see people. This is so wrong. Outside of the state of California, even online. So disciples will send me a, can you see me? Can we do online therapy? And I say, unfortunately, my license is in the state of California. So what I do, disciples do, they fly in or they drive in and they come and see me for a week. So they see me for intensive therapy. They come for 2 days. They come for 2 hours every day and we do an intensive. Because, you know, there's a certain level of trust, right? You're a disciple. I want to see somebody that's a disciple, and you specialize in certain things. Well, it's really a bummer. We'd have to go all the way up through Congress because it's a law thing that doesn't allow you. There is no national licensure. And this is a problem in most of the helping fields. There's not many of them don't have national licensures, national accreditation. So therefore, people will say, well, about coaching. Coaching has no regulation. There are no regulations on coaching. So people can be a life coach, and they can provide all kinds of services with no regulation. This is a problem because people are doing therapy with the name coaching. If that's some of you out there, I apologize, but let me explain. Without the training and supervision and laws that make sure that therapy is for your benefit. So the ethics that we're going to talk about at the end are so vital. I actually had somebody who came to me, and I'm going to talk about EMDR in a minute, and they had done a training in EMDR. The person that came to me was their friend had gone and done this training in EMDR, which is a specific type of trauma therapy, and they'd just done a training, and they sat with their friend and did it with them. It brought up all of their trauma memories, and for a year they had flashbacks, horrible flashbacks, and then came to see me, and I was like, ah, okay, so this is a re-traumatization that there just wasn't knowledge about what to do. I have people in the church who will come to me and say, I provide coaching because therapy, you can't do it between states. And I'm like, that's still therapy, and actually that's against the law. You may get away with it your entire life, but it is actually not legal. So coaching is a whole separate, awesome field when it's done in the way it should be. For instance, how to have good job performance, how to work through choosing what you want to do in life, how to work on motivation. It is not for anxiety, depression, sexuality, and so on. Most coaches overlap into dealing with anxiety and depression. That's a really questionable overlap, but people do it all the time. Now, the reality is sometimes people are getting that help and they're super grateful because that person really helps them. And I think that's valid. The help is valid. It's just that you're going into really murky territory. You're going into more than murky territory legally and ethically. When you're providing, you cannot claim to give those treatments if you don't have those licenses. We do have the thing about laws and ethics is it keeps harm from happening. If you know anything about some of the crazy stories that have happened through the years, there's whole books on the crazy things that people have done in the name of therapy or in the name of treatment that were very harmful. It's because we didn't have laws to say you can't do that to people. Well, now we do have laws. Well, we didn't used to have laws, even around therapists. Now we have them to keep you safe from people that don't know what they're doing and that could do you harm and that could bring up your trauma with no way to work through that trauma or whatever else. So I'm explaining this. I don't mean to be quite as negative, and I'm realizing I'm sounding that way. Mostly you want to be an informed consumer. You want to be an informed. I tell people, when you're coming to see me, you're a client who needs to get a good service. In fact, you're paying me some money. I think I told you this. Sometimes we joke. People call me I'm their paid friend. You're paying me some money, and you should be getting a good service for this money. It should help you, right? And so it's vital that you be an informed consumer. If you've engaged in coaching services and they've been helpful for you, great. If I had a conversation with the person providing those and they were doing things, sometimes I say something, sometimes I don't. I usually gently, and this happened actually just this week, where I say, I don't do those online in other states because that's therapy. So that was my one little, just so you know, that's therapy to somebody who was providing coaching. So it's, you know, I try to monitor my own field in some way. It's important that you know that so that you're getting the kind of care that you're hoping for. All right. There's other fields. This is similar to developmental psychology, but the field of child therapy and child psychology is its own. I actually mentioned that a little bit more later too, but there's a whole separate field of substance abuse counseling. And these are not licensed or master level therapists. They are certified. So again, there is quite a bit of regulations around these specific certifications. So specific to the substance abuse field, it's probably the one of the levels where it's just certification that's the most regulated. Like way different than, say, some of the other certifications that are out there. Most certifications are not regulated. They regulate themselves, this field. And one of them is a KDAC, but there's a bunch of other. I am a certified chemical dependency counselor. You can do it through a university. You can do it through one of these national organizations. If somebody is working in a substance abuse facility, they will often require that person to have these different levels of training. So it's just important that you know, though, that somebody with one of the substance abuse KDACs and so on, that doesn't mean that they have a master's level therapy license. So there's a difference in all of these fields. And so I ran the clinical supervision for a rehab. And so I was supervising all of the training MFTs who were working with the clients at the rehab. And there was a whole separate supervision group, and those were the KDAC supervision group. And one of the things that came up was that they were kind of battling with each other, the MFTs and the KDACs, for various reasons. The KDACs feeling like the MFTs don't have enough training in substance abuse, and the MFTs feeling like the KDACs don't have enough training in therapy. I would actually say that both are true. There's truth to that, but there's no reason for the fight to happen. Like, how can we work together? So it's an issue. There are specific forms of training for the military psychologists, and that would be Air Force, Army, and Marine psychologists. That's literally, someone will put that in their title. It's not a separate degree usually, but the title that they'll use for their job will be military psychology. I already talked about clinical. So a cognitive neuropsychologist is going to work less with, say, how their brain is controlling their limbs and the neurology involved in movement and functioning. And they're going to work more on how the brain is involved in all of the cognitions and the thinking. So there, again, even in the field of neuropsychology and neuropsychiatry and there's all kinds of different ways that the brain is involved. San Diego is actually one of the leaders in research on the brain. And so we have all kinds of folks in that field here in San Diego. And then you have an environmental psychologist or a cultural psychologist or a community psychologist or a consumer psychologist. What does that mean? Most of the time what that means is it's their area of specialty. They have a degree in psychology. Sometimes certain universities provide the actual degree in that. So It just kind of depends. And then you have a health psychologist, which would be similar to the idea of a sports psychologist, where you're working with the body and how you live it out, geriatric as well. So that, again, those are areas more of specialty than the actual degree. Okay, that's a lot. So any questions on any of that, on the types of therapists, trainings? Yeah.
Can you in the first session talk about the reason, the good reasons for diagnosis, then today you'll talk about the whole battle of
right.
The different schools of thought. So is it, when you mean that, you know, therapists are skeptical as far as diagnosis, is it diagnosis as far as official to tell the person, or even as a therapist, you're kind of in denial of saying, well, I can see this person has this issue, but I'm not going to tell them, or lie?
It's not a denial piece for most.
Right.
For most, it is an issue of labeling, that when you put this name on it, it puts this person in this category, and that's problematic. So most MFTs would say labeling is problematic to their process. However, I think somebody who's got a little bit more of a balanced view is going to go, there's a purpose and a use for labeling rather than a reactivity to it. I let the person tell me if they want to find out what their diagnosis is, and we will go through an assessment. All MFTs are trained in assessment. Actually, in the state of Texas, they took it to the Texas Supreme Court, where the field of psychiatry, one of the big ones, sued to say that MFTs couldn't diagnose and give the label. And that would have been a really big loss, because it would have had repercussions through the United States. They lost. MFTs were, yes, you have the right to. So they all receive the same training with the DSM. They can use the DSM. The field of MFT tends to be, that's a dysfunctional view of this person. Perhaps the reason why they're having these problems isn't because they have a dysfunction, but because the system they're in is dysfunctional. So MFTs are more focused on the system than they are on the, you're the reason why you have a problem. So there's a different view between all those different fields on diagnosing. Other questions? Yes. Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. You go to a doctor and they stick the needle in and they pull out a blood sample and they send it to the lab and they go, oh, you have low this or high this, and so we need to give you this. Or they do a swab and they send it to a lab and they, oh, and it grows and, oh, well, you have this. And so they know exactly what medication to give you. It's always not that clean and clear, but there is no, people doing brain imaging would disagree with this. There is no way to do that with psychology. You can't stick a needle in the brain and suck it out and say, oh, you have low serotonin, so you need an SSRI. The only way that they decide is by your answering their questions, by doing assessments. You can do the assessment on paper, or you can do it verbally. So it's quite problematic, because we have this teaching. So I'm going to answer this a little bit longer, because this is important. We have this view, doctors even use this term, is that you have a chemical imbalance.
Okay.
How do you figure out the balance? Okay, because you can't stick a needle in and suck it out and measure how much dopamine and serotonin. They do in rats. So all of that is based on the study of rats and animals. Just so you know, the actual head of the American Psychological Association at a conference back about a decade ago said the idea of, what's the word I just used, chemical
imbalance
is a useful metaphor. That's what it is. It's a metaphor for, we think you have, because your behaviors and the way you're feeling, what you're expressing may show. Now, we do know that certain behaviors in rats and mice are affected by the levels of serotonin, dopamine, and all those other chemicals in the brain. So those chemicals are on the brain, and they all affect behavior and emotion and all of that. We just don't have a way of figuring out what they are. Now, most recently, I'm kind of lying about that, because most recently they actually are taking swabs from saliva, and they can somewhat tell levels of all of those brain chemicals in the saliva, but this is really early research. And now they'll say this has nothing to do with serotonin and dopamine, but they'll do a brain scan and they'll say, oh, this brain scan shows this, so therefore you need. This has mostly to do with the brain mood disorders. The mood disorders are very hard to diagnose because you're just diagnosing it by what people share with you, which is actually highly effective, but it's not effective like taking a blood sample would be. I feel all kinds of things about the use of brain images, and actually the field of brain imaging has a lot of feelings about people using those brain images to diagnose, because that's, we've been doing that for years. Oh, I didn't even talk to you about all this. Phrenology, did I talk about phrenology? So in the history of psychology, where they would tell by the shape of your head what was wrong with you. Folks, that's what we're still doing. By the shape of your brain, you have a smaller prefrontal cortex. You have a larger this, and so therefore, and I actually have received quite a bit of training in this, and I just go, really? What the heck? So yes, sometimes what people can do is they can say, you have this. Now that's super applicable to people with brain disorders, where you can actually see what alcohol does to the brain. It shrinks the brain. Literally, it shrinks the tissues of the brain. We know that if you do certain types of, that's what's so different with Down syndrome. We know exactly, we can tell exactly why someone has Down syndrome, right? It's not so clear on all of the rest. We're still learning. We're probably going to find them out. I mean, that was a huge finding. Just to figure out that one. We're going to find out a few more as we go that are biologically, organically based. Mood disorders, are they biologically and organically based? I think the biology and the organics and the chemicals of the body are heavily involved in all of the disorders. We just don't know how to measure them. And so what happens is, so now that I've just slammed the idea of chemical imbalance, the reality is, so, you might have one. We just don't know what it is. So they ask you some questions, and then they go, well, let's try this medication. How'd that go? You see them in about 3 to 4 weeks. That's why they make the appointment, and you need to go to that appointment, and you need to call them and tell them exactly how it went and what your side effects were, because then that's going to help them decide, you know what? I'm thinking maybe you should do this one instead, or we should lower it, or we should up it. I have somebody who just recently, she upped hers, and she was like, it was like night and day. All of a sudden, I was remarkably doing better. So if you see a good doctor, there are some really good doctors that combine all of the Western medicine, the use of medications, with alternative practices so that you can pay attention to nutrition, because what you put in your body is huge, that you can pay attention to the use of all kinds of other remedies that are out there, but you're doing it under the care of somebody who can pay attention to how this medication is interacting with this herb you're trying to take. So what people do is they'll try to mix all of these things, and the herbs and the supplements are not regulated. And let me tell you, they affect your body because you're putting it in, it goes in systemically. So it's really important to see somebody who gets how these different things you're putting in your body or doing to your body, how they affect your life and your functioning. So you can involve all those things. I would just highly recommend that as far as what they decide, so a homeopathic doctor, as far as how they decide, is going to be very different. They do all kinds of different assessments. What's vital is that whoever you see knows what they're doing, you know, and then it's a shot in the dark. In all reality, most mental health medications and treatments are try this, that didn't work, and then there's side effects, and then you end up taking some other things to help with the side effects, and those are kind of a bummer. Most mental health medications are only studied, they're only researched for certain populations and for a short amount of time, but they're used long-term. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm just saying that we don't really know the effectiveness of long-term use and whether somebody should continue. And so what psychiatrists tend to do is they do keep writing the prescription. So, yes.
Two-part question for a friend, I guess. Not really.
Not for you.
In the mind, is it unrealistic to go, okay, let's do medication for long term, uh-huh. or if it's more as need based. And then the second part to that question is, I know that there's side effects and those commercials that scare me.
Right. And you will die.
And, oh my gosh, no matter how soothing that female voice is,
right,
people.
Right.
So you
can
talk
yes.
about,
so let me answer
why
both.
Is it more so in young people and
right, right. The first question was
long-term.
So, most medications are studied for short-term use. They are used long-term, and we're only now beginning to get the studies on the results of long-term use. Okay, so it's still even that part's growing. However, yes, there are plenty of people that use them to alleviate the symptoms so that they can get back to functioning and work on the underlying things. So I always tell people who are a little are resistant to the idea and maybe they need to utilize medication is this isn't for the rest of your life. You can try it out and see how it works. And it may get you to the point of functioning so that then you can take care of these other challenges in your life that you're having a hard time focusing on because of where things are at right now. Some people then when they are not on those medications, return to a lot of very distressing symptoms, and the medications keep those symptoms from being present, and so they do stay on them long term. When it comes to children, that's just a whole separate field. There are a lot of issues and a lot of concerns and a lot of disagreement around the use of medications for children because we just don't know what the effects are on the developing brain. So there's a lot of different views on whether you should ever, some say you should do it as early as possible because, oh my gosh, then they won't have this years and years and years of problems. Others are like, that's the last thing you should do. It should be the last thing, the last resort. So there's very differing questions, but there was a specific part of that you asked me. Suicide. So the problem with the suicide warning on all of the SSRIs, it needed to be there because, yes, suicide ups in the use of those. Why is that? Basically, the entire field will answer pretty much the same way, is that when you take a medication, it ups your functioning. And when it ups your functioning, you have a higher chance of actually finishing the suicide. It doesn't have to do with the drug.
So you're saying it was underlying?
Yes. Yes.
The medication brought it to the surface because they're functional.
The medication didn't bring it to the surface. The medication made them functional, so now they're no longer not able to function, and they have the strength and the ability to think, and they'll actually perform and commit the suicide. So this is important. It's not actually the drug, and so that's why when people go on drugs, they need to be in therapy, they need to be getting help and support because you want to make sure that when these different underlying things come up, they're getting the support and the help that they need. So we need to take a break. We're going to go for until right at 10, so a potty break, and then we will return. I'll see you at 10. And that was just through slide 6.
Should we wait for more questions later?
You can do whatever you want.
Reparative therapy. It was suggested for same-sex attraction by a sister.
No.
And it freaked me out. And I'm like, what is this?
Who was the sister?
Sister
Sorry.
In Vegas. No.
You need to have her read my book.
Okay. Because I only began it.
That reparative therapy is become heterosexual.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was. And then touching on it, and I'm like, I don't even know.
So opposite
go
from
here.
Everything that we would believe.
I know. And so my son's been in therapy and on meds, and it's really
you
been
can't
great.
Do it. It's actually against the law in California.
That's
you cannot
why
do
it was
you
not,
can't
I've
do reparative therapy
so
in California.
She sent it to me, and I was like, gosh, this sounds like. And Jonathan is familiar with it.
Yeah.
And he's been like. And I didn't mention it to him, but he had shared something. I'm like, it sounds like that crazy.
Yeah.
So, okay.
No, they actually just had a convention here, and they came to a class I taught at The Rock, and I didn't realize who they were, and I was like, and then after they left, I was like, that's why they were asking those questions.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yes.
But, you know, and it just my even beginning watching it, it was
This individual has not read Guy Hammond's. The person that gave you that input has not been reading Guy Hammond's work.
You should send her.
No, seriously.
And we shared with them, like, you know, what we've been learning through this. Okay.
Yeah.
Good
to know.
Oh, for the record, music therapy has been around since the 60s.
Yes.
You said a couple decades. It's
well,
more common.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Florida State.
It's now used in the hospitals. It started getting used in the hospitals a couple decades ago.
I had friends from the 60s that went to Florida State.
That's so great.
And they're the profession.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it until I went to music school.
Yeah.
So I probably was relatively new at Arizona.
Yeah.
But
that
yeah,
was the 80s.
Dr. Madsen.
Okay, very
psychologist
cool.
Psychologist slash... music professor.
Very cool. Yeah, and wish I had.
You know, you talk about that coaching. I mean,
yeah.
Okay, I get a degree in marketing, and now I'm an evangelist.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know if they're doing therapy or not.
They often are, and yeah, the field, the laws have to take care of it, and so I just educate people and. Let them do what they're gonna do, but at one point people are gonna get slammed for it. That hasn't happened yet.
You know Paul Ciccone's brother Chris?
Uh huh. Yeah.
He's a licensed counselor.
Okay, an LPC. Yeah. 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 All
kids.
Kinds of different ones. Oh, there you go. Thanks for the historical correction.
Only music major would know that.
I know it.
Do you need a break? You got
huh?
a minute?
No, you're good.
So I remember when the Thrive Conference was in for like parent like with special needs and stuff.
Yes.
This actual question came up one of the last sessions about the different schools of thought about parents wanting to let their kids know about their diagnosis.
Yes.
Versus no, so it was funny because I was the only one in the class that on that group that was actually in one side of the other like side. So most parents would think that it's better to acknowledge and tell the child you're autistic or you have this or that to get the help. And the reason I was asking the question was that so as a therapist, you do still look at those symptoms and at least you have it in your mind kind of an impression of a diagnosis. And if you would choose if the patient wants to know now. So,
oh, no, I have the diagnosis in my mind.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Up.
No, if I...
So
yeah,
as a
yeah,
parent
yeah.
now, so I'm not a therapist. So what happened to me, I mean, I didn't know I had ADHD until like, I was 30. Before law school, I accidentally found out. But I excel throughout my life. So I'm just wondering, had I known, maybe I would think, oh, I'm limited.
Right.
So, but I excelled.
Right.
It didn't limit me. I was always...
This
and
is actually the
in
huge...
inclusion theory. Mm-hmm. So now my son is showing the same symptoms. So I do not believe in medication, but because, again, I was able to survive and excel in life. But I'm wondering, so having... So I don't want to also be selfish, but I saw in my life not knowing help a lot, and that's what I had that school thought.
Right. I think... How old is your son?
He's like almost 6.
So he's young.
Yeah, but so as a parent, I can almost hold on to the diagnosis. I mean, I'm his big advocate because I'm seeing everything that I went through in him.
Yeah.
But you would recommend having the child know or not?
In varying stages. When they're 6, you're going to be using other terms.
Just tell them you're special.
Sometimes
you know?
Kids have these differences, and sometimes those differences are hard because they feel like I'm not like other kids.
Exactly.
And so you're using more broad language. What
so I'm
I usually
coaching him.
Sure. What I recommend though is as they get older, they're going to start hearing these words. And so it's important to hear it from you, where you can say, well, so there are, I'm sorry, I'm selling something, that there are some, you would qualify for this diagnosis or you have qualified for this diagnosis. This is what it means. That's
three
a
books.
Very appropriate.
Three.
Great.
I mean,
that's
what
a,
were you talking about?
You are.
I got one from my friend.
So it's
actually
really
gonna
good.
My kids,
oh, that's,
three adult kids.
Oh, I love that you're doing that. Good
you
for you. What a compliment. Oh, sorry. Sometimes it's just rude.
Some of them.
Go ahead and sign.
I'm going to have that available.
Which, right as we start, can you remind me to say something about all this?
Church of Christ guy.
Got it.
So not Jared Jones, because I know Jared Jones has written why.
Go ahead and put your email in there.
The one that he had on marriage divorce is kind of like the book on marriage divorce.
And I think you know her, Cheryl Cooley.
Okay.
And you know, and I know. And I think it was just general.
I'm actually kind of surprised. Okay.
So was I when I first assumed that what
so
it was.
She just might not realize what it is.
No. I don't know if she actually awesome. Watched it, but she mentioned a brother that was going through it in the Vegas area.
Oh, Lord. Are they reading Guy Hammond stuff?
I you know read that? And the parts of that book.
As far okay. as just being
you're
thorough,
good.
Fair.
I don't know if one. We also bought three for our kids.
Let me know when
the
you
last
get
time.
One.
And I'm like,
so
we can buy ourselves
great.
One.
That's so great.
I should have one by... Are you but going to the singles conference in 2 weeks?
She, Tyrone has his son from the previous.
Okay.
He's gay. So I don't know if that all that or how much
how that affects things.
Done, but we discussed her
yeah.
name. She's familiar with it. And
yeah.
So when I got that, I was like, sure, this kind of sounds familiar, but I wasn't
yeah.
sure.
So reparative therapy is against the law in California for a reason. It's quite damaging. Also, it doesn't work.
Well, my son researched different things a while
yeah.
ago, and he was pretty freaked out. He goes, there's this therapy mom that does.
Yeah.
And it was like,
yeah.
well, that's not.
No.
That,
yeah. No.
So,
nope. You made a good call.
Just to wrap up, is
yes.
age-appropriate
explanations.
Okay.
Because actually it is important that then at one
I think
point
me having
they
added
become a part of the choice.
Kind of, right.
And I actually appreciated my pediatrician. She said, at one point, if you start, this was with my daughter, if she starts wanting to go use marijuana and alcohol and she's self-medicating for these symptoms, then you should probably involve her in the process of whether she might want to go on some kind of treatment, medication, something like that. And I was like, what great input. So when she got old enough, we explained
right,
the whole
course.
Thing. She was probably about 12 when we first talked about it. So this is what they're saying. What do you think? These are some of the medications, and these are how they work, and these are some of the side effects. And she was like, no, I don't want to do that. So she made
she
that choice.
That
and then
age.
We revisited that choice through time
mm-hmm.
On both kind of the kind of treatment that she got and medically. And it's funny, looking back on it, I just think it was important to involve her age appropriately in the process. We
right.
didn't tell her that when she was in second grade.
Right, okay.
But
so
as
that,
she
about
matured,
that age, the when there's some kind of...
I think it's different per kid.
Okay.
It's different per kid. It's
okay.
different per parent. It's different per family.
I don't want to
see
them either up saying, oh, no, you're
right,
just
right.
no different, you know. And
yeah, no, I would talk about the differences pretty openly even
right.
now at six.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, this... Because it's bothering... Let me tell you,
oh,
it's
yeah,
bothering
he's
him.
Already struggling.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he doesn't want to play, you know, play with me,
yeah.
and, you know, so-and-so.
Yeah.
Like, that's okay. Has
yeah.
to play with you. I mean,
yeah.
And that's going to be a special
yeah.
and all that.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
There's
okay.
a specialist.
Any book they recommend?
Terry Wilkie is a specialist in ADHD here in San Diego, and she does coping skills.
And coaching, too.
Coaching.
For adults,
huge.
Too.
For adults and
for
kids.
Do you have a...
Terry, I don't have her card, but it's W-I-L-K-E. Terry Wilkie.
Wilkie?
Yes. I don't... I've met her personally,
yeah.
and I just look at her stuff, and I think, oh, my gosh, you're awesome. I don't know anybody that's gone to her, but I recommend
oh, really?
Her.
You're
okay.
going to go up
oh,
soon
okay.
enough. It's not worth
okay,
it.
Okay, I'll go
thank
up.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to ask you.
Can you? I hate to
okay,
do this,
that,
but can
well,
you ask me after?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to have to leave.
Okay.
My sister's seeing a counselor. She's got marital
and by the way, this is being recorded.
Oh, all right. Well.
Do this. Can you send it to me in an email?
Yeah. Is this the last class?
Yes.
Okay.
This is the last class.
Just quickly, is it Terry Wilkie?
With an E.
At the end?
No, no,
no
I.
Yep. Got it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, let's go ahead and start. Okay, remind me again as we start. Hey guys, I don't have a microphone today, but if everybody could grab their seats. Okay, so we will see what we get through today. I have a bit of information, but we will get through whatever parts we're supposed to get through today. What we've done so far is we've talked about the types, right, the different fields, models of therapy. Okay, so I'm going to go from there. Raise your hand as we go. You can get therapy in a lot of different ways. You can go see somebody individually. You can go to a group. You can do couples therapy, marriage therapy. You can go as a whole family. You can go into a ward at a hospital, an inpatient ward. You can do an intensive outpatient, which often happens when somebody's been inpatient, then they get involved in an outpatient. Or you can just go directly to outpatient, which means it's varying levels of intensity. It can be all day, 8 to 5, where it's groups and individual, or it's 3 hours a day, 4 hours a day, or it's 3 to 4 hours a week. So there's different levels of intensive outpatient. Then there's outpatient, which is like not as intensive. You don't go as often. And then there's the hospitals. There's different places it's provided, in hospitals, in rehabs, in clinics, in private practices. So there's a lot of different ways to be involved in therapy. There's a lot of different ways that people are trained. So if they're trained in psychoanalysis, in psychodynamic, that would be more of a Freudian model, although that's probably not super fair because it's much broader than that. It might be focused on personality, which tends to be a little bit more Freudian as well, meaning that the approach that they take is how your mental health is reflective of the type of personality that you have. It might be what you call a social model that's focused more on social learning. So the things that you learn through life and in families and in communities and how that can be cause challenges. It might be more thinking oriented, more behavior and cognition oriented. So that would be the CBT type of theories. I did some of this, by the way. If this is unfamiliar to you, I talked about a bit of this on the first week, on the history behind therapy. The person that you're seeing might be more focused on development and on learning and their learned behaviors or the development of these different challenges. There's a whole different field specific to therapy that is humanistic and experiential. I fall there, but the reality is I use all of the above. But I'm an experiential therapist, and that would be focused on the value of the person. And experiential means you do it in the room as much as possible. So you're not just talking, you're doing quite a bit more in the room. More currently, for those who have any training in psychology, some of these words are even then unfamiliar in the postmodern. So modern would be family therapy and the such. I'm going to show you some other ones. But postmodern would be, EFT doesn't really fall under postmodern. It would be EFT, emotion-focused therapy, which I'm an emotion, I use emotion-focused. CBT, why did I put that? No, sorry. I'm mixing these up. These are other kinds. CBT is cognitive behavioral. Mindfulness-based is much more recent, where you're using being in the present, being in your body. And then definitely big time, what you'll see in all of your insurance plans is that it has to be evidence-based. And there's really, CBT is the most evidence-based. EFT is also evidence-based. DBT is evidence-based. EMDR is evidence-based. My therapy is evidence-based. There's not a lot of support for most of the other therapies because they haven't done what you call the gold standard, where they've done a randomized control trial to see if it works. So, but that is one of the requirements a lot of times for certain financial coverage of services. So I'm kind of overlapping here. All right, third bullet. Attachment lens means you're paying attention to the pattern of early attachment in between parent-child and how the patterns of interacting, either through a secure attachment or what you would call an insecure attachment, which creates anxiety and avoidance, then gets carried into adulthood, and those patterns are repeated in adult relationships. So that would be attachment. That's like a 10-second bite on what attachment therapy is. I use attachment. These are just some of the names for those in any kind of a family systems model. Bowen, structural, brief, strategic, experiential is one. Postmodern is called solution-focused and narrative. So you're going to go on, and it's going to say, like if you go on to Psychology Today, it's going to say, I'm solution-focused. And you're like, well, shouldn't everybody be solution-focused? Solution Focus is actually a type of therapy. Their most well-known intervention is the miracle question. I use it all of the time. And it's if you went to sleep and while you were asleep, a miracle happened and all of your problems were fixed, gone, and you woke up the next morning and they were gone, what would you do that morning? It's a lovely therapy. I use multiple techniques from Solution Focused. I'm an experiential therapist that steals from a lot of the other fields. And so it's not just find a solution. It's actually a really lovely form of therapy. Narrative is similar but different, meaning these are not problem-focused. Most of the other therapies are problem-focused. You have a problem, let's fix it. Narrative and solution focus are not problem-focused therapies. So they're quite lovely. Scott Green, who just died, was a narrative therapist. And I don't have time to describe what all that means to you. But there's a whole field that's just marriage therapy, couples therapy. I'm actually teaching the course on couples therapy at Bethel and preparing for it. And that's what my training is in. And it's got its own set of types of therapy. Most people in the office don't do couples therapy. It's a bit more challenging because there's a lot of conflict in the room. And so that is predominantly what I do. And then there's all different kinds. I mentioned child psychology, so there's all kinds of different ways of doing therapy with children. There's different modes. My favorite is PCIT, which is parent-child interactive therapy. It's used with young and developing children. I think it's the best thing as far as children. And then there's also the whole field. It's a whole field in and of itself, of play therapy. I am trained in play therapy because I worked so much with kids, and I still use it. I love play. I do play therapy with adults. I just think it's like the best thing ever. So art, using art in therapy is huge, whether you do it in the office or you give it to people to do and so on. So I have loads of materials on the stuff that I've done with children and adults using play therapy. Super, super helpful. What else is there? Trauma-informed CBT is a form of CBT, but the focus is trauma, right? Well, almost all of the fields now are developing a trauma-informed approach, meaning all the things I just showed you, you can put the word trauma-informed and there's going to be a section of specialists who use that same type of therapy, but their focus is using it to deal with trauma, which actually is most people are needing to address trauma. EMDR is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. So it's a trauma therapy, and it's the belief that the two different sides of your brains, separated by the corpus callosum, need to communicate better with each other. I'm like totally messing this up. And you use what you call eye movement. So they use the finger in between to, like people think it's hypnosis. It has nothing to, well, it has very little to do with hypnosis. Or they use tapping, or they use sounds. And what they're trying to do is connect the two different parts of the brain. And then while you're doing that, you're doing an open association, kind of Freudian looking, where you just start talking about different memories, and up will come the trauma memories, and then they heal those memories, and they do lots of trauma work to help with how to breathe through it and relax through it, but then how to process it so that then when you're done processing the memory, it doesn't have the same effect on you. So that is a butchered version of what EMDR is. I have 5 different therapists in my office who use EMDR. I don't use EMDR. I do a trauma therapy with couples on how to help the healing happen in the couple's relationship. Motivational interviewing, I love motivational interviewing. So if you see these words, I'm just letting you know, these are going to be the words on their sites. I use motivational interviewing techniques. I think it's awesome. Expressive arts can be dance, art, music, all of those. There are actual specific trainings at, I think it's UCSD, in expressive arts therapy. I've taken some of them because I like all that expressive stuff and art stuff. So there's equine therapy and dog-assisted therapy, all kinds of different animal-assisted therapies. there's not a heck of a lot of research yet on the animal assist therapies, and we need it because I think it just sounds like really great. And we know our case studies, which means that they've written about people who have gone through it and the great results. We just haven't done any, there's not a lot of good research on it yet. And there needs to be because I think it's an emerging, very useful tool. I get asked, does it help people if they have a dog? Work through depressive symptoms. I get asked that pretty regularly. And I always tell people, from what we can tell, it's very helpful. We don't have a lot of research to back it up, but people, their case study support for it being very helpful. So you can go to Neurofeedback. There's an institute, a couple of them here. There's actually all kinds of therapists that use Neurofeedback. I don't, but it's quite common. There's going to be a number of practitioners in any city. Brain stimulation is predominantly used for the mood disorders, especially depression. ECT is the longest one. This is the electroconvulsive therapy where they actually send shockwaves to the brain to relieve depressive symptoms. It's been highly misused, and it's had problems with it through the years, and then it's the one you see in all the movies, and it's incorrectly shown in the movies. I have multiple clients who use TMS and DBS, deep brain stimulation, as well, and they find it incredibly helpful for when they're in the brain stimulations are not always, but predominantly used for those in very deep depression whose functioning is very challenging. And so definitely the individuals who have come to see me who are also involved in that are like, I go from not being able to function at all to being able to at least be engaged in life. So that's one of the types. And then, of course, you have all the different kinds of support groups. I have somebody right now, I said, go find an OCD support group. And she came back from that and she was just like, oh my goodness. I was like, oh, there's other people like me. And they were sharing what helps them. And then she also said, but it was kind of disturbing because I was like, oh, it exposed her to all the traumatic ways that people are dealing with this problem. So it's got its support groups have their pluses and minuses, right? But one of the great things it does is it says, I'm not alone. So there's others helping out. When you're actually choosing a therapist, I tell people, if you have insurance, absolutely, go use your insurance. The reality is you go try out a therapist. You don't like them, go to another one. You don't like them, go to another one until you find one, because the biggest thing you want is connection and rapport. It is the single greatest factor that creates change in therapy. Literally, across all of these lovely things I just showed you about the types of therapies, the single greatest factor that creates change is the connection you have with your therapist. So go try them out and go to somebody else if you have insurance. People often want to see a faith-based therapist, and I think that's vital because you'd want to see somebody that that doesn't diss the different things you're working through spiritually. Sometimes therapists are not trained in spirituality, and they actually do damage to those who want help with the faith with their faith in the midst of it. So, but then that would be often through almost all faith-based. That's not true. Many faith-based therapists are in private practices. But so I'm on an EAP program, and I keep getting these calls, and the EAP program has me on their list of faith-based therapists, and I'm like, oh. That's cool. I didn't know that they would assist you with finding somebody with Christian beliefs. That's awesome. So I've been quite impressed with that. And so I have a number of clients who just use their EAP for a few sessions and come and see me because I work in a Christian office. What you need as a therapist can change over time. What you need when you're 20 might change when you're 40, might change when you're 60. So it does change over time. There's a big difference, too, between how therapists work. So I would say one of the biggest differences would be somebody that's non-directive, where the process of just you sharing it with them and them asking you questions is changed, that they guide you towards finding your own strengths. They guide you towards finding your own new way of thinking. They guide you towards you have the resources within yourself. It's lovely. I use pieces of non-directive, but everything in my body is directive. If you haven't figured that out just by seeing my personality. I'm pretty directive, which means I'm very involved in the session. So it drives certain people crazy, and they don't ever want to see me again. And other people, they've seen a non-directive therapist, and it drove them crazy, and so they ended up seeing me. So you just want to be aware that who you go and see, who they are as a person, their training, their background affects what they're giving you. And you should go shop.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. And so, and sometimes people are the exact opposite, where they want to see somebody of the same gender or they want to see somebody of the opposite gender. Actually, with sexuality, I always ask men, now, how do you, I'm quite explicit. I'm a female, and we're going to be talking about your penis. How do you feel about that? You know? And he's like, I'd actually rather talk to you than another male. Okay. You know, so that's just specific to sexuality. But yes, some people feel safer or whatever. They just feel something and it works better for them if. So gender, I always bring it up when I'm working with somebody of the opposite gender to just check with them. Not all therapists actually do that. I think it's important though that you, because if you're a male therapist, there is an issue of more power in the room. And so it's important to explore that. If they're a good therapist, they should. So paying attention to the, as an older therapist, I explore it. I'm older, and I'm sometimes decades older than the person that I'm with, so I will explore the power differential there just by my being older, and so on. I'm going to talk about culture at the very, very end, because race comes into it, and cultural backgrounds comes into it, and I'm going to share with you how I approach that, because I think that cannot be explained about how important that is. So what is the rapport that I just mentioned to you? That would be, so the biggest thing that they would say about what makes a good therapist is the ability for them to have empathy. Carl Rogers, if you know anything about Rogerian therapy, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, his stuff was, but it undergirds the field of psychotherapy now, which is a good thing. When you go there, do you feel supported and validated? That's vital. So when you're choosing somebody, make sure you have a good connection. I can't tell you the number of people, yeah, I kept going because I was like, you know, surely this is going to help. And I'm like, well, how was your connection with you? Well, not so good, but I kept thinking, surely this is going to help. And I'm like, you know, you might want to think through that. You might need something different that works better for you. Now, you know, so this would be totally from my view. Growth and change happen when the environment is open and functional. This is true about families, right? This is true about the kingdom, where people feel heard, validated, valued, and acknowledged. Well, that's how you should also feel in therapy, and if that's not happening, you might want to consider a change. So this is me. I'm systemic, I'm directive, I'm experiential, I'm emotion-focused, and I use ACT, which I explained when we did the mood disorders. Okay, I have to skip some of these things. Okay, so what's a session look like? The first session is always assessment, where tell me what brings you in, and tell me what brings you in now, what instigated you coming in now. So I'm looking for immediate factors and what they're wanting out of therapy, and that is vital because from there you should do goals. You should have specific goals of what you want to accomplish in therapy. If you don't feel like, or if somebody's going, that you're helping them through their process and their therapist hasn't talked with them about goals, that's problematic. You should have specific things you're working towards. Whenever I feel stuck in therapy with somebody, I realize we need to go back and clarify what we're doing, what our goals are here. So goals are a huge part of the process of assessment to termination. And let me tell you this. One of the most common things that happen is that people feel helped or they don't feel helped, but even when they feel helped and they've been seeing somebody for a while and then this happens and this happens and this happens and so they discontinue therapy, but they don't have a termination session. I tell you, you should always have a termination session, even if you're ending therapy earlier than maybe because of money or you're moving or always, because it's an important relationship. You've done a lot often in that relationship, and it's important that you wind it up in a healthy way. So a termination session is actually quite important to the process of therapy for people, especially if they're going to go somewhere else or even if they're going to return at a later time in their life. So typically sessions are about 50 minutes. I'm not always great about holding to my 50 minutes. I have to be done within 60 minutes because I have somebody else walking in the door. But there are some therapists that do an hour and a half. In psychiatry, it's much, much shorter. It's usually, you know, 5, 15 at the most, except for the first session. And I've shared with you, I'm going to show you some techniques that I use very briefly. But there are a lot of different techniques that you may not even realize what they're using. So turn to the person next to you. Face them. Physically move. This is all you're going to do. Decide who's going to speak first. And you're going to say, one of the things that happened yesterday that was really a positive for me was. The person listening is going to say, one of the things that was positive for you yesterday was. And you simply mirror it back. You don't put any interpretation. You don't add extra words. You just, as best as possible, share with them what you just heard, okay? So the person who's going to go first. So this is not a paragraph. This is 1 to 2 sentences, maybe 3 at the most. Because for the other person to reflect you, if you give them a paragraph, they're not. It's going to be a little hard to reflect it, right? So share one thing yesterday that was really positive for me was, and then the other reflects it. And then the other goes. One thing that was positive for me yesterday was, the other reflects it. Right there. We're going to take about 2 minutes to do that. Go. Yeah, take turns. Make sure that the other person does it. Good. Oh, good. Okay, let's go ahead and wrap that up. You can ask him. You can share with him. Okay, let me ask you something. Let me ask you something. How was that? Awesome. Awkward. Depends. It was great. Point. You know, isn't it funny? Just that little bit, just say something positive about your day yesterday, and it can create like a, oh, do I know this person? Do I want to share it with them? What will they think? How many people wondered what the other person was thinking? Oh, come on, put your hands up. Right? Okay, but what I've just shown you is a basic technique that I teach my students when I'm training them how to become therapists, is what you call reflection. The simple art of, but let me ask you this. How much did you have to pay attention when they were sharing? What do we tend to do? We get distracted. We're thinking about how we need to respond, and right? So this would be the art of active listening, which I think can be actually pretty empty if you don't go all the way to empathy. But it is a technique, actually, and hopefully your therapist does it well. But it is something that we can also give, is just to say what you just heard. Now, I have a question. You don't all have to answer this, but who felt some empathy and compassion just by hearing it reflected by the other person? Right? And it's funny because when I train my students, they're like, sometimes they role play and they're not even doing a real person, or they're role playing somebody in their family. And they're like, I just feel better. So there's so much to be said for the art of really hearing and listening. I mean, you can't even measure it, right? So I've just given you a flavor of one small, I use reflection non-stop in a session. I don't want it to sound like I'm parroting them. That's the biggest concern, is I feel like I'm just parroting what they just said. It can feel like that initially, but it's funny. The more you do it, the less it feels like that. So there you go. That's your training for today. How do you, in the midst of therapy, integrate spirituality? This is the way I do, is I check people's support network within their spiritual environments. Do they have connected relationships? Do they feel like it's safe, that they can be open? Do they have discrepancies between what they believe and how they're living? Because that discrepancy, it's not about, oh, repent, sinner. It's about, that causes quite a bit of anxiety when what you believe and how you're living, it doesn't matter if it's religious beliefs or not. It can be morals and values that you have in life. When you have those values and you're not living them, there will be a fight internally. Some religious therapists will use the word sin in therapy. I don't actually ever use that word unless they do. Because that member of experiential therapy, you would actually say it's mistakes are an opportunity for growth. So if they use the word sin, I will use the word sin just to use their same language. But their discipling partners can help them with their sin. What I'm more interested in is what got them there, what was the process like, what happened afterwards, how it went against how they believe and how they want to live and who they want to be as a person, and so on. So there's a difference. There is a huge difference between discipling and therapy, just in case you're wondering. I am a therapist and I've led ministries. So there's different hats, and it's important because sometimes religious therapists don't know the difference, and they often will go into one or the other. So just so you know. And again, one of the biggest things I would always recommend, and I do this, is focusing on who God is, not what he does, although that's awesome too, but his character and his heart. So I have found myself, because I get to do this, because I'm in a Christian counseling office, I get to openly suggest some things that might be a little harder to suggest if I was working in a clinic, where you're still supposed to be able to use those things, but if someone's spiritually based. But what's great is everybody coming in pretty much to my office, not everybody, but about 95% are actually looking for that. So it's been lovely, because I feel like in my own life, that's the single greatest thing that brings about change, is knowing the character of God. What does the Bible say? This is just for you to do in your quiet times. 2 Corinthians 9:7, not doing things out of compulsion. Christ's love compels. Grace teaches. So helping people with motivation in the spiritual environment of therapy is helpful. I do give scriptures when people ask for scriptures. I don't usually hand them out until they've actually let me know they want them. Shame and guilt and growth in the midst of therapy is a huge piece in all therapeutic environments. But what's great is that as a disciple therapist, I can actually really pull it in. Because 2 Corinthians 7 actually says that we're supposed to feel godly sorrow and we're supposed to feel shame. The field of therapy says you shouldn't feel shame. But shame has its place. Jeremiah 6:15 actually tells us that we should blush in shame. In fact, if we don't, it's problematic. Luke 22:32, when you blow it, you learn, you turn back, and you help others. So what do you do when you feel shame and then repentance comes? And you look at David, you look at Paul, you look at their changes and their sorrow about sin. So those can be involved in therapy. This is the biggest thing that I work on in therapy is genuine communication, vulnerability, connection, and empathy. And there's lovely verses that support that. Speak the truth in love, open wide your heart. Jesus, where it says that his heart went out to her. You know, God wants us to process these things, and Satan does not. He wants you to keep it to yourself. So how to have open, genuine communication is huge. David's a great example of that. He wrote poetry. He sang. He talked to Jonathan. He ran. He prayed. He meditated. David is a great example of what it would look like to go to therapy, actually. And the field of psychology is paying attention to how important meaning and purpose is. Well, we got that down pretty good. But how do you broaden that to loving God, loving others, to shining like a star, to holding out the word of life? I love Isaiah 32 that says each man will be a shelter. Most people want to give and love others and they're not sure how to. So that brings meaning and purpose. The message of reconciliation, 2 Corinthians 5, we are his ambassadors, he makes his appeal through us. So there's all kinds of different meanings that people have in life, and so helping them discover them is vital to the process of therapy. These are some other techniques that I use. What you just did was reflection, which would be on the right there at the top, right? Joining is the connection you have with your therapist. Empathy, when people are suicidal, I use a safety contract. I use a lot of psychoeducation where I actually teach about therapy in the brain and in session. I use a lot of psychoeducation. I do play therapy. I teach breathing big time. I do desensitization skills, which means that, like I had a woman who was very worried about having cancer, and we literally wrote the word cancer out on a piece of paper, and she put it on her chest because she was very afraid of getting it, and we said the word cancer, and we desensitized around the word cancer, and, you know, desensitization is a CBT skill that's very useful to anxiety disorders. Emotion identification, which I've spoken about before, is huge to the process of treatment. And then emotion management. I do role plays in office. Even when somebody is just an individually seeing me, I'll either role play the other person. I do that actually pretty regularly. So that's because I'm an experiential therapist. I'm going to do it in the office. But then I also do role plays between people when I have more than one person in the room. We talked about guided imagery. I use homework. Not all therapists give homework. An automatic thought record is how to take every thought captive kind of idea. Broadening their support network. I do BCT, which is behavioral couples therapy. I give action plans for people that are in the midst of use, any kind of addiction for triggers. I do a contract when people are in the midst of dealing with addiction. I do an empty chair technique, which is the person is looking at an empty chair and they're talking to somebody as if they were there. It's a very powerfully evocative technique. And we're all going to do this next one. So everybody stand up. This one is a little bit painful. So you can decide not to do it. So stand in groups of two or three. So everybody be with somebody. All right. And so we're going to do sculpting. And what that means is you're going to ask the other person, do I have permission to touch your body, and obviously this just means in the acceptable areas. And so, do I have permission to touch your body? Okay. So this is what we're going to do. I'm going to show you a sculpting exercise. What you're going to do today, this is where it can be quite painful. You're going to sculpt you and God, how you currently view or overall view you and God. Okay. So. Yeah, I'm traumatized, everybody. Yes, can you come on up here? Is this okay with you that I use you as a...
Yes.
Yes? Okay.
You have the permission.
I'm going to do the sculpting, so you don't have to do yours in front of everybody. Okay. You do this with no words. That's my sculpture. Thank you. Take a seat. I just came up with that right there, so I didn't plan it ahead of time. The reality is, your sculpture might be a lot different than the one I just did, right? If you don't feel comfortable to do this, say, I'd rather not do this today. And your partner can just do theirs, okay? So these are very brief. Notice we did that very briefly. When I do it with people in session, I take actually quite a bit more time to do this. I do this with families where I have them sculpt their family. Woo! So interesting.
Wow.
I have couples sculpt their relationship. Woo! Right? I have them do it before and then at the end of therapy. So, and you see this huge transformation in what their sculpture looks like. So you're going to do you and God. Okay? So if, by the way, if you're uncomfortable doing you and God, you can do you and your parent. That's even a little more, right? So you decide between those two, actually. Just let your partners know what you're going to do. On your mark, by the way, this is brief. Don't take a long time to do it. A minute each. On your marks, get set, go. Okay, go ahead and grab a seat.
Don't try to sculpt your marriage at home without the
without the therapist there. How was that? It's great. How was that? Great. Awesome. Difficult. Different. Awkward. This is a pretty, when I've had people in my office where I have them do them and I'll be God and they sculpt it, often, in fact, most of the time what I get is, that comes up a lot when I do them and God. When I do couples, you see, they show me. They're on opposite sides of the room with their backs to each other like this, or all kinds of other things, right? It's a really helpful, simple, both an assessment technique and it can be used in the process of therapy, and then again, it can use at termination to really see change. What your therapist is trained in is what they'll do with you in that office. I'm an experiential therapist, so the two things we just did today with reflection and sculpting is the kind of things that I do in my office. You may see any number of other things. We just did a couple of those. In the process of therapy, there's growth that can happen when you go as an individual. But if you can ever pull in family members into therapy, if you can ever do family therapy or couples therapy, the level of growth that can happen is exponentially higher. So that's just important to know. Honestly, what also means change over time is that through the process of therapy, you're expanding that support network that we talked about earlier and expanding. Okay? I always recommend follow-up sessions. Not everybody takes me up on that, but I highly recommend after you've been seeing somebody for a certain length of time, you do follow-ups a month later, then maybe 3 months later, then maybe 6 months later, then maybe a year. So that's what I do. I do 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year follow-ups. Honestly, one of the biggest things that we know this biblically that helps us maintain change is ongoing openness with somebody we trust, right? And then, of course, if we're, while doing therapy, also doing our own spiritual growth, we know that Jesus is really the author of change. God causes the growth. So our spiritual growth through it makes a huge difference in keeping the change going after you've gotten the psychological help with a therapist. So you guys, what can you do with people in your life? I didn't bring it. I was going to actually read, and we don't even have times anyway, but these pages in Rejoice Always are just lovely in how they talk about this person that goes to therapy and what it might look like and how they're helped, or but how the disciple helps them through it. So these are the steps straight out of Rejoice Always. Learn to listen, remembering it's not your job to be a therapist. How do you respond when they're traumatized? We've talked about that. That's vital. Help them stay close to God. Help them find creative ways to study the Bible. If it's hard because of the different challenges they're having, they might need to listen to it. Jacqueline, what's that app? That Bible app that's got this, it's got the little videos? Can you look it up and tell me right before we're done? So there's this really cool app that like has these storylines with it, and it's just like, and then it shows you the scriptures, and I'm like, cool. You know, we've got to, when things are tough, sometimes you listen to the scriptures with an audio Bible. I actually downloaded a free audio Bible just, you know, to get the flavor of that. And somebody did it for free, and you can just for whatever reason, listen. The Bible Project. It's funny, Jacqueline first brought it to me, and then I've had multiple people say, have you heard about the Bible Project? So, very cool app. Thank you. Help them focus on honoring God by doing the right thing, regardless of how they're feeling. How to do that, right? That you can still obey God, even when these things are challenging. What that means, the word obey, is going to be so different per person. What does that look like? Also, absolutely, if they're suicidal, making sure that you have increased safety, supervision, and that their environment is safe. Make sure, help people get in the fellowship. You might have to modify it. They might need to plan for fatigue. They might need help with their schedule. If they miss a service, do you bring them notes and you send them a link to the video of the service? Do you bring the Lord's Supper to them? Making sure that they're in relationships with other disciples who are supportive and can really relate. Helping people with mental health challenges with serving others, how to be giving, because physical movement and involvement with others is actually a huge part of the process of treatment. How to be giving, and how to have safety, you know, within the fellowship. Don't overlook sin. You can still help people with their sin, even when they have mental health challenges. It's more how you help them with it. Make sure that they have constant encouragement. We see that from the scriptures, right? That we need daily encouragement to instill hope. But also deal with your own stuff. Because sometimes when you're helping somebody with some different mental health challenges, you can feel frustrated. You might become critical. You're challenged with providing compassion and empathy, or you don't really know where the boundary lines should be on where am I helping and where am I doing stuff that is actually not helping. It's actually I'm doing too much help, and so I'm not helping them in the way I really should. If you feel burned out, if you feel like you want to say to them, just get over it. So you want to get help with your own stuff, all right? If they're in treatment, encourage them to adhere to their treatment. Keep their appointments, follow up with doctors. If they're on medication, they shouldn't make changes in their medication without talking to a doctor. After hospitalizations, make sure that they're getting tons of support. Realize that the very medications they're on could have side effects. You're not the one that's going to help them figure that out, but they can share it with you. You know, have them ask their doctor, and then they can share with you what their doctor said, so that you can be supportive in whatever way you can be. And then pray for their therapist. have them pray for their therapist. Ask God to give this maybe secular therapist with no religious beliefs wisdom so that they can really help and God can use them as a tool. Because you know what? God can hear that prayer. So pray, just like you would pray when someone, we all pray for when somebody's a doctor's hands when somebody goes into surgery. We should be praying for somebody's therapists, right? Seek input. Pray, ask advice. If you're helping somebody and you're not quite sure how to help them, seek input. Pray, ask advice. And if hospitalization is necessary, it's not, remember this, it's not always the cure, but it may be necessary. But afterwards, they're going to need some significant support. Just so you know, the laws, this is going to be done in 30 seconds. It's absolute confidentiality. I cannot give identifying information of anybody that I see. Clergy are mandated reporters for the same things that a therapist is. So clergy is anybody employed by a church or who has an ordained position, which would be elders and deacons. Evangelists, elders, deacons, and anybody employed by a church are mandated reporters for safety, meaning child abuse, elder abuse, not for the sake, but in the way that's different is that a therapist has to make sure that they're providing good care for suicide. It's not a mandated report for suicide, meaning you don't have to report somebody's suicidality. There are laws, though, that if you say you're going to kill somebody and I know and you've said who they are and you've told me how you're going to do it, I have to call the police. So there are mandated reporters, and that applies to clergy. The challenge with large healthcare systems is that the records do become, so this is the, one of the problems with, say, the military or with large healthcare services, is that those records are seeable by the practitioners within that large healthcare facility. And so you actually have to sign that. It's in your sheet when you get the paperwork. It says that in your paperwork. But like I said, for mandated reporting, you have to break confidentiality. Therapy never includes sex, just in case you're wondering. It's all over the TV shows, right? Right. You can't do that. What's the show my husband and I were watching, and the woman walks into the guy who's in, it's like a Western show, and but today. And she walks in, they end up, yeah. And he's a cop, and he says, da, 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 and she gives him a file. You can't do that. You know, and then she's in a relationship. I mean, like, and all the, it's this big thing of therapists that have relationships with their clients. Like, you lose your license for that. It is actually the number one reason that therapists lose their licenses. That and DUIs. So drug and alcohol use, and if you get a DUI, it can be suspended. You'll definitely have some kind of, you have to put it down when you renew your license. You have to actually mark if you've had any of those charges, and then it'll be suspended, and usually those get renewed if somebody's in good care, but with sex with a therapist and the numerous other offenses, you can lose your license, sex being one of the greatest ones. In the law of California, somebody has asked me, can you do somebody should be involved in reparative therapy for those with same-sex attraction? It is against the law in California, and honestly, reparative therapy is terrible, in my personal opinion and professional opinion. And so it is against the law in California, but it also is against the law to actually even address with minors same-sex attraction. So it's a problem in California. It's gone all the way to the Supreme Court. It's going to get ironed out through the years on how you can honor the person's needs who's coming to see you. So, a bit of a challenge there. And the other law is that you can't have a dual relationship. So that's why if somebody knows my children, if they've eaten in my home, if I have a personal relationship with them, then I don't see them in my office. I refer them to another therapist. But it's a little challenging because we all eat at the same table. So the lines for me can be a little challenging, you know. But I let people know up front, I actually can't see you. This is what we can do. Or I can, but you need to realize you're going to see me, and that most a lot of people are like, I don't want my therapist in the same place where we're all singing and praying during service. So that's a really, really important piece. Minors do not hold their privilege. Parents can see their records. However, if minors go in for certain things, they can receive that help without the parent knowing, and that would be if there's abuse going on, if there's substance abuse, or if there's anything sexually going on, or if they want an abortion. All of those can be done without parent approval. I put it right there. If harm is likely to ensue in the absence of treatment, either to the minor or another party, parental consent is not required. Okay, so in other words, if there's something that's happening with the child, but you're concerned that the parent might be harmful to the child if they find out, then you can actually make that choice as a therapist not to share it. I tell parents, don't ever ask for your child's records. If you want them to openly come and talk to me, don't ever put your right for those records into practice. So I have that conversation with every parent that I work with. I just talked to you about mandatory reporting, duty to warn. I have a secrets policy with couples where I tell them I don't hold your secrets. So if I have an individual appointment with a husband and he reveals, or with the wife and she reveals something that's detrimental to their relationship, I let them know in order to continue doing therapy. I will never reveal your thing, but we would need to find a way for you to reveal that. I just did that with a couple where there was some stuff. It wasn't an affair, but it was pretty big stuff, and the husband did choose to go ahead and continue therapy. He did share it with his wife, and of course it has created all kinds. I let people know it's going to create a lot of stuff. So then I work with them through the process of what I call disclosure. But I don't hold their secrets. So there are therapists that do. So you need to know what their secret policy is before you do marriage therapy. Because some will hold the secret, and some will say, like I do, that I don't hold secrets. You always have to sign an informed consent, including for online therapy. When patients are not physically present during the provision of therapy, therapists take extra precautions to meet their responsibility to patients. So this is when you're doing online therapy. It's harder because you can't see them. There's risks, there's consequences, there's benefits, but there's limitations. There might be transmission difficulties because the Skype goes down. Oh my gosh, it freezes right in the middle of them crying. It's like the worst thing ever, and it happens to me. Ability to respond to emergencies. If somebody is suicidal, you have to make sure that they have somebody that they can go see right there in the town they're in. And there's a special informed consent for online therapy. So this is important, and the last thing I'm going to say is that we could do a whole class, and we should have done a whole class, on culture. Because race and culture, absolutely, gender differences, racial differences, cultural differences occur in the therapy room. And the therapist should be multiculturally competent. So MFTs are actually trained in multicultural therapy. They strive to identify and understand the diverse cultural backgrounds of their clients by gaining knowledge, by their own personal awareness, and by developing sensitivity and skills. So there should be a continuous effort to be aware of how my own cultural, racial, and ethnic identity, values, and beliefs affects the process of therapy. Because it does. So I do ask clients. I was working with a couple that were, both of them were black, and I said, so, you're black, I'm white, I'm a female, you're a male. How is this for you? You know, does that bring up anything for you? Because the reality is it can. And I had another couple that both Asian, and they were like, no. And then about, I don't want to say about 10 or 12 sessions later, he was like, you know that thing you asked about, that Asian thing? This is actually one of those. And so a therapist, if they're multiculturally trained, will at least open the door to how to have the conversation, because there's a vast difference in approaches culturally to therapy and to the use of therapy. You've got large swaths of society that don't feel comfortable going to therapy, and I want to be able to talk about that. You can tell me that, and maybe we can work through that to some extent. How do you feel about that? I might not understand your background. Can you educate me about your background? And that, can we involve that in this process? So it can work when you have differences either in gender, in age, in race, but it's really important to talk openly about it. So, when I do work with individuals who might come from a background, I was working with one, she just came to use her EAP. She had 5 sessions. And in one of our sessions, she brought something up about her background. And I said, can I ask you something about your background? So I always ask permission. You're black. You grew up in a city here. Did you experience anything? I know. Like, even saying did you is just kind of crazy. Tell me about your experience. And she spent the whole next session just sharing with me about the things that had happened to her through the years. And it was so, she said, I've never had anybody even ask me that. Let me tell you, we need to be doing that in the church. I was just at the Unbox conference yesterday, which is it's all disciples, and they're talking about sticky subjects, and the whole night, first night, was on culture and racism, on racial issues. And one of the things that we talked about was that we don't talk about this as a body. And I shared about how I got to do in my, I have to take diversity. You have to take diversity when you're in therapy, when you become a therapist. And it was, I tell you, my diversity class, you know how we all study the sin study, right? And you're repenting. Oh, it's really challenging, right? Oh, you're getting a D time. That's really challenging. Oh, right? That's how this diversity class was. I thought I had dealt with my prejudicial views because I became a disciple, right? That class was so in your face. I was like, oh my gosh, I think that. I've done that. I've said that. I mean, it was like a sin study nonstop for a whole semester. I would come home. I would come home and I would tell my husband, oh my gosh, I just thought I dealt with this. And I just, So it was a great process for me, right? And then one of the jobs was I had to go, they said, if you were born a different sex, meaning a different gender, and you were born a different race, what would your upbringing have been like? Go interview people and write a paper on it. Well, I have all these lovely brothers and sisters, so I decided to be a Latino male. And I went and asked three of your brothers, who are Latino, what their upbringing was like. I had known all of these brothers for 15-ish years. And I was like, when they shared with me their background. And these are brothers I thought I knew. And I was so, wow. It was so helpful to me to understand that my experience isn't the same as someone else's experience. And we need to talk about that openly, honestly. So learn from your brothers and sisters. So it was a really great time. You can actually go listen to the talks from the Unboxed. They have them recorded online. John Oakes did on race. We've done a number here. And so go listen and go grow, because that's also happening in the room. That we are totally past our time today. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, we just want to do a little extra. Thank you so much for Tim's not here, but Jennifer. To Jan for making all the arrangements. Next fall, we're going to have a class on Acts, starting probably the last week in September. It'll be a 6-week class.
Nice.
You, myself, and Pedro, and a couple of the younger guys, we're kind of trying to raise up as teachers. That'll be good.
Pedro's.
And we should also have a fall Bible workshop coming up. So
nice.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, John.
See you later.
In Florida.
Unboxing is here.
Well, I know, but do they have one not too long ago?
Yes.
Yes. Morgan.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Watch them.
He's in Colorado, and he's actually taking. He's in the Navy, and he's taking some theology classes.
Oh, you should send him my way. We have a group that meets regularly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Please.
It's been amazing.
Good.
So.
Yeah, we've had a few that are doing that. Jeff Harris is doing that.
have hard vows.
No.
I didn't even know there was such a thing. Oh, this is the teen edition. Great. I have no idea what you're looking for. She probably paid like $3 or $5. This year, I'll just look at the $3.
Oh, yeah.
You probably paid at least that. I don't want to make money on it.
If you can only find $2, I'll take $2.
Great. Thank you. Sorry about that, yeah.